Good morning. It's great to see everyone. And I want to give you a warm welcome to week three in our series, On the Trail with Jesus. Through this series, we're taking a 40-mile hike from Nazareth to Capernaum, a walk that Jesus would have taken many times. And we're stopping at various places along the way to see what we can learn from the geography, the archaeology, that can help us to better understand some of the stories that we read in the Gospels. So here's the route we're taking, and you might remember we went from Nazareth to Cana in week one, and then last week we went from Cana to Levi, and today we'll go from Levi to the Sea of Galilee. As we start our hike this morning, I want to point out some of the trees that are growing around us. Here you can see some carob trees. Carob trees produce pods that start out green and turn black, and in ancient times these pods were used for weighing heavy metals. That's where we get the word carob from, as in 24 karat gold. The pods were also used for animal feed. You might remember in the story of the prodigal son, he leaves home, spends all his inheritance, and eventually ends up working on a pig farm, wishing he could eat some of the pods given to the pigs. And these are those pods. The carob tree is also known as the locust tree, and it's very probable that where it says John the Baptist ate locusts and wild honey, it doesn't actually mean the insects, but the pods of the locust tree. A little further on, we can see fig trees. Figs and fig trees in scripture are a sign of prosperity. And as you can see, as we get a little closer, they are in season right now. We also have olive trees, of course. The olive tree is the national tree of Israel, and it's a symbol of resilience and vitality. These trees are surprisingly fire and disease resistant, and consequently they can grow to be very old. Some of the ones along the trail we're hiking are believed to be over 1,000 years old. Throughout the centuries, olive trees have played an important economic role, with their oil often referred to as liquid gold. And right now, the olives are green, with it being August, but they'll start turning black around November. So let's watch this brief video on olive pressing in the time of Jesus.
Hello, my name is Majd, and I'm one of the guides at Nazareth Village. We are standing in our fully functioning replica of a first century olive press. We are entering the rainy season at the moment, November and December, and this is the olive season, so our villagers already started harvesting the olives off of the trees, and we bring them in here in order to press them. Of course, olives are hard. You cannot just press them right away. The first thing you do in the process is crushing them, and that's why we use this big stone over here. Mosey the donkey is helping us move the stone around, and this stone will crush the olives and the pits. Everything needs to be crushed so finely until it turns into paste, and then it's ready for the next stage of pressing. The crushed olives then are placed in baskets like the one you see over here. We're hanging it on the wall, but of course you lay it flat, and then there are pockets to the sides where you put the crushed olives in preparation for the actual pressing process. And then you take about 10-15 baskets to press them together at the press. Now the baskets are brought over here and stacked on top of each other. Underneath them, there's a hole in the ground that is about 2 feet deep, and it gets also a bit wider as it goes in. So as you press the baskets over here, oil is going to gather underneath. The beam of wood sits on top of the baskets, applying its weight as pressure, and then the three weights, the stone weights, are lifted using pulleys and leverage in order to apply more pressure on top of the baskets. Each group of baskets gets pressed three times. The first time you apply pressure, you get the best quality oil. And according to the Jewish law, the first of your fruits you offer to God. So the oil from the first pressing, they will not use at home. They will take it to the temple in Jerusalem. The second time they applied pressure, they got good quality oil, and it was used for food, medicine, perfume, and cosmetics. By the time they got to the third pressing, though, the quality of the oil was really bad, and they would use it for oil lamps and making soap. The olive press has a very strong connection with Gethsemane. The word Gethsemane comes from two Hebrew words, Gat Shmanim, and they literally mean press of oils. And the olive press is a great illustration of the pressure that Jesus was under as he was praying in Gethsemane, to the point he even started sweating blood. And he prayed three times, an equal number to the pressings. And even Isaiah 53 says he was crushed for our iniquities.
We're going to continue on the path now along a steady incline to the Horns of Hattin. These twin peaks were formed by a volcano, and some people believe this is where Jesus delivered the Sermon on the Mount. although others say that was on Mount Eremos closer to Capernaum, and we'll get there next week. Hattin was the site of a famous battle between the Crusaders and Saladin on July 4th, 1187. In the 1100s, various Christian aristocrats from Europe and Western Asia had established themselves in Israel, and most of them had signed truces with local Muslim rulers, and they were all busy enriching themselves at everyone else's expense. But one of these aristocrats, Reynald de Châtillon, who was a particularly cruel and hateful character, decided to enrich himself by massacring Muslim pilgrims and stealing their goods, which inevitably led to war. Various Muslim factions united under Saladin's command, and the Christian rulers called on the Crusaders, as well as hiring hordes of mercenaries, and they all marched up to the horns of Hattin. This was a serious tactical error on the part of the Crusaders. Although they had the advantage of elevation, they had no water supply up there, and those who were sent to go and find water never came back. So Saladin lit fires all around the hill, and then archers shot through the smoke at the Crusaders, who were already greatly weakened through dehydration, and there was an absolute slaughter. Well, lots of books have been written about this battle. It's very famous. There's a whole range of videos on YouTube that you can check out if you're interested, including a Lego version of that battle. Although I should warn you that it's still not very kid-friendly. But it is much less graphically violent than the movie The Kingdom of Heaven, which depicts this battle at some length. And as shown in the big battle scene of that movie, the Crusaders took with them into battle what they believed to be the true cross of Christ. That's also shown in the Lego version, actually. And the Crusaders were convinced that because they had the true cross, they could not possibly be defeated. In fact, according to the 12th century chronicler Anul, when the Pope heard the news that the Crusaders had in fact been defeated, he keeled over and died of shock. How could they possibly lose with all the power of the true cross? We'll come back to that idea later. Well, the horns of Hattin also provide a wonderful view. You can see to the east the Sea of Galilee with the Golan Heights in the distance. The peak in the middle of this photo, slightly to the right, is Mount Arbel, and that's where we're headed. And if we had time, we could descend the northern slope to Nebi Shuabi, which is the holiest place for the Druze people. The Druze faith developed out of Islam in the 11th century, and it has its own secretive theology that includes reincarnation and eventual unification with the cosmic mind. There are roughly 1 million Druze adherents, mostly in Lebanon, Syria, and Israel, and they believe that this is the site of the tomb of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, whom they view as their chief prophet. But we're going to continue along the Hattin Ridge down the path to the summit of Mount Arbel. And if we were physically there right now, we would be lining up to get our photos taken at this spot. This is our Kodak moment. But since we're not here, I guess we'll just have to do a little photoshopping. There we go. We're going to descend the steep cliff now. It's about 1,300 feet down and there is no guardrail, so we're going to have to be very careful. Partway down, you can see a fortress that was built in 37 BCE as part of a Jewish uprising. The rebels hid out in caves all along the cliff edge, and King Herod was sent to put down the rebellion. He lowered his best soldiers in baskets over the edge of the cliff to access the caves, where obviously then the rebels were trapped and killed. Lots of killing today, I'm sorry about that. The path then continues down and finally reaches the Sea of Galilee at Magdala, home to Mary Magdalene. Magdala was a thriving port town in the time of Jesus, and it was discovered by accident in 2009 when a Catholic ministry bought the land to build a hotel and retreat center. And before any new construction in Israel, by law, the Israeli Antiquities Authority has a right to check for any ruins or artifacts of significance. And to their surprise, they found a first century synagogue. Let's watch a short video from soon after that initial find.
The remains of this ancient synagogue were discovered on the site of a planned hotel north of Tiberias in Migdal, the town where Mary Magdalene once lived.
These finds along the Sea of Galilee represent some of the oldest discoveries ever found in this region. Some experts say it's certain that these are the places where Jesus lived, taught, and healed the sick.
We presume that this synagogue this beautiful, decorated, well-decorated synagogue was maybe the synagogue that Jesus and his community and Maria Magdalena sat together and learned and study and prayer together in this building.
The building would have been huge, nearly 1,300 square feet in the main hall. It was decorated with frescoes and had a mosaic floor, and most of the stones were left standing or lying intact. Israel Antiquities Authority archaeologist Dina Avshalom Gorni is heading the excavation. She says they also found an unusual stone inside the synagogue.
In the middle of the synagogue, just in the middle of the benches around the walls, we found a base of a stone which was decorated also with a menorah.
The seven-branched candelabra was part of the temple in Jerusalem. A few depictions of menorahs have surfaced, but this one is unique because it's far from Jerusalem and in a synagogue. Experts say this sheds light on the links between Jewish communities in the Galilee and Jerusalem in that day. IAA archaeologist Yossi Stepanski says the artist himself might have been capturing what he actually saw on the stone.
The artist himself may have seen the original menorah in the Second Temple and used it for himself when he engraved the menorah here on this stone.
Avshalom Gorni says it's remarkable the synagogue is so well preserved because it was found just a few inches beneath the surface.
After 2,000 years, nobody damaged this building. It's unbelievable. And it's so beautiful also in archaeologists because the hotel could be built a little bit to the south, a little bit to the north, and we could miss it by a few meters. We can miss this unbelievable evidence.
Despite plans to build on the site, Stepanski says he's certain it will be preserved for Jews and Christians alike.
I think everybody wants the public also to see the synagogue and maybe even a chance to pray in the synagogue. A synagogue that's here for 2,000 years, that's a big treat for anybody.
You can see the excitement in the archaeologists' faces, can't you? I just love that. Since that video was made, the area has undergone extensive excavations that have revealed a large number of first century houses, as well as Jewish ritual baths with their distinctive seven steps, and a marketplace. The main industry was fishing, and here you can see troughs that would have held fish in the market. We know the town sent pickled fish as far as Rome, so it was quite the industry, obviously. Further excavations have also been made in and around the synagogue that was clearly very beautiful during the time of Jesus, with mosaics on the floor that have got traces of red and black paint and brightly coloured frescoes on the walls. We tend to think of ruins in terms of grey and sandstone colours, but actually it's believed that many first century buildings were originally very colourful, and we can glimpse that here. In what appears to be a reading room off to one side of the synagogue, you can see a table with grooves. There are two theories about this. Some say it would have held the spindles of a scroll to keep it in place while someone was reading. Other historians say that they think a chair fitted on top of the stone and the rabbi would sit up there to teach. So I guess you can pick whichever of those you like the best. But the most controversial find, which was mentioned in the clip, is what has become known as the Magdala Stone. This too was almost certainly brightly coloured, so you would have seen the symbols much more clearly than we can today. And some archaeologists think it was just simply a piece of decorative furniture using traditional Jewish imagery. But quite a number of others think it depicts the temple in Jerusalem in miniature, with very specific religious symbols representing the Holy of Holies, the veil or the curtain in the temple, the showbread, the incense, and other sacred items in the temple laid out as they are in the temple. And this is significant because it was long believed that synagogues prior to the destruction of the temple in 70 CE were more like community centers. Men, women, children would gather together and sit to discuss local governance issues, to share communal meals. It would serve as a school and sometimes as a hostel, as well as it being used for reading scriptures and teaching on the Sabbath. But if this Magdala stone was a careful representation of the temple, That suggests that synagogues were viewed as more holy places than that, that at the center of the synagogue was a very intentional reminder of the temple, and maybe even the suggestion that God's presence could be found not just in the temple in Jerusalem, but actually here in the center of a small town. And this is an ongoing controversy among scholars of Jewish antiquity. But obviously for followers of Jesus, this seems a really cool discovery, because almost certainly Jesus taught in the synagogue. It's thought there weren't actually many synagogues in Galilee in the first century, and to date this is the only one to have been uncovered. And it lies on the road from Nazareth to Capernaum, and we read in Matthew 4, Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness among the people. So whether or not the artist who made the Magdala stone realized it, God's presence was to be found in the local synagogue, and sometimes in a very tangible way in Jesus. Unfortunately, though, this beautiful synagogue only lasted until 67 or 68 CE, when it was destroyed by the Romans. As I mentioned, the land is owned by a Catholic group, and they have, somewhat controversially, built a chapel over the center of the marketplace. You can see here the market paving stones at the bottom of the photo. And on one wall of the chapel is a huge mural 16 feet wide called Encounter, painted by the Chilean artist Daniel Cariola, depicting the story of the woman who touched the edge of Jesus' cloak and was healed. This is a story we've read many times, but we're going to read it again today. The story is sandwiched in the middle of another healing story, and so we're going to read that one too. It's a bit long, so I've asked Steve English to read it to us.
When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders, named Jairus, came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," the disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion, with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha koum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat.
Thanks so much, Steve. Now, we don't know that these miracles happened in Magdala. We know Jesus had just returned from the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and Magdala was a harbor town, but he could also have been in Capernaum, his hometown 6 miles down the road. But it was somewhere in this area, in a town on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. This story is in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and it's a very vivid story. There are plenty of eyewitness details that enable us to use our imaginations and really enter into that scene. We have Jesus and his disciples who've just arrived on the shore, probably busy tying up the boat, taking down the sails, and so on. And people hear that he's back, and quickly a large crowd gathers. But pushing his way through to the front comes Jairus, one of the leaders of the synagogue, an important person, no doubt a man of means, an educated man, but he's frantic, he's beside himself, and he throws himself at the feet of this young rabbi and pleads with him to save his daughter. That would have been quite a shocking sight. And Jesus doesn't hesitate. He gets up and starts to follow Jairus back through the middle of the crowd, away from the shore and up into town. So soon the people who were at the back of the crowd are now at the front of the crowd, and everybody's pushing and trying to keep up with Jairus, who's practically running, desperate to get Jesus back to his house to save his 12-year-old daughter. And all of a sudden, Jesus stops. And you can imagine everyone kind of behind him bumping into one another and asking, you know, what have we stopped for? I thought we were going to Jairus' house. And Jesus calls out, "Who touched my clothes?" Seriously? Poor Jairus is almost out of his mind. The girl's dying. Everyone's got turned around. It's all chaotic. And Jesus wants to know who touched his clothes. You can understand why the disciples got more than a little frustrated. I mean, it's a crowd, right? That's kind of what happens in a crowd. Lots of people touch each other. What's the big deal? You know, let's stay focused. Let's get Jesus up to Jairus' house and get on with it, you know? But Jesus is insistent. He felt power going out of him. So everybody has to stop. Poor Jairus is probably totally losing it. And the disciples, they're probably like, "Did you touch him? Did you? What about you?" You know, trying to figure out what's going on here. But then from a few rows back, we can imagine a tentative hand goes up. People turn around and see it's a woman. And it's not just any woman, it's that woman. The one everyone knows is cursed. She bleeds, and not just once a month, but continually for the last 12 years, for as long as Jairus' lovely daughter has been alive. And women who bleed have to stay secluded. They're unclean, and their impurity is contagious. So they're not allowed in public spaces. She shouldn't be here. You can imagine all the people closest to her in the crowd recoiling. What if her clothes have touched their clothes? They'll have to wash everything and have a bath in one of those 7-step baths, and they're still going to be unclean until nightfall. So they can't touch anyone or anything for the rest of the day, or those people and things will also be unclean. So basically that's their whole day shot now. Thank you very much, woman. Go back home. Keep away from us. You've even made Jesus unclean. But as the crowd draws back, the woman approaches Jesus and throws herself at his feet, shaking like a leaf, and starts to try to explain herself. She tells him how she spent the last 12 years desperately trying to find a cure. She spent everything she's got. She's got nothing left. She's ostracized from her community, cut off from her own family probably. She can't buy or sell in the market. No one will employ her. She's always tired and got headaches. And it all just seemed so hopeless. She just felt like giving up. And maybe the woman raises her head and sees Jesus listening, like really listening, encouraging her to go on with her story. So she tells Jesus how she heard all these stories about him, and she thought, if she could just touch the corner of your cloak, I know I shouldn't, but if I know I have got no right to be here, but I just had to try. And then with tenderness that the woman had probably not heard for many years, Jesus says, "Daughter, your faith has saved you." It doesn't say that Jesus helped her to her feet, but I bet you anything he did. No one was unclean to Jesus. And we don't hear any more about this woman, but I bet she went home looking a good 6 inches taller, with her back straight and her head held high for the first time in a long time. But at that very moment, some people came from Jairus' house to tell him that it was too late. His daughter had died. There was no point in bringing Jesus with him now. It was all over. Perhaps at that moment, Jairus was numb. I hope he was. In a state of shock from that dreadful news, I imagine Jesus taking him by the shoulders and looking him in the eyes as he said, "Don't be afraid, just believe." And then Jesus sent everyone away except Peter, James, and John. He didn't want an entourage. He wasn't there to put on a magic show. Jairus is in distress and Jesus is moved with compassion and on his way to help. But this is not for the crowds. It's not about being seen or becoming famous. This is about Jairus and his daughter and their family. Whether this was at Magdala or Capernaum or anywhere in between, the towns were not big and it can't have been very long before they arrive at his house. But already the mourners were there, yet more crowds, more commotion. And Jesus asks, "Why all this wailing? She's not dead, she's just asleep." And it says they laughed at him. I bet that was quite a bitter laughter. Again, Jesus sends a crowd away and he goes with the girl's parents into the room where she lay. Dead bodies, like bleeding women, were considered unclean and contagious. So for the second time, Jesus is confronted by a nameless and unclean female, someone who he absolutely should not touch. And of course he does. He takes her hand and speaks again with real tenderness. "Little girl, time to get up." And she does. And Jesus says, "Now bow down and worship me for this amazing miracle I have performed." He says, "She must be hungry. You should get her something to eat. And don't tell anyone about this. Let's just keep it between us." Wow. What a beautiful story. All the way through, Jesus seems so loving and kind and gentle. So what are we to take from all of this? Well, I'd like to make 3 points. Everybody makes 3 points, right? I have to make three. So the first is, the way of Jesus is the way of the cross, and the way of the cross looks absolutely nothing like the crusaders riding into battle to slaughter the enemy. Rather, the way of the cross is about loving our enemies and turning the other cheek, as we were talking about last week. Throughout the Gospels, we see this tension between Jesus performing miracles and the crowds gathering and everything seeming to go well on one hand, but on the other, Jesus refusing to be what people wanted him to be. Refusing to lead an armed insurrection, or to be a populist leader, or to use his power to gain supporters, or to dominate in any way whatsoever, and being repeatedly misunderstood and rejected as a result. One commentator described this as the paradoxical yoking of Jesus's acts of powerful liberation and his self-giving powerlessness. In this story, we see crowds gathering around Jesus and the disciples close by his side, and people coming to him desperate for his help. But we also see the disciples frustrated with Jesus, and we hear the crowd of mourners laughing bitterly at him. We think of the Magdala stone, which may indicate people's longing for God's presence to be with them right there in the synagogue. But we know that so many people ultimately rejected Jesus, turned against him, yelled for him to be crucified. Jesus was filled with life-giving power, and yet he was crushed, like olives in the press. This is the way of the cross, and this is what we are called to do. The second point I think the story brings out is that everyone belongs. No one was unclean to Jesus. No one was unimportant to Jesus. Time and again, we see in the gospel stories Jesus totally going against rules about purity, ignoring social norms about who was respectable and who wasn't. Rabbis were instructed to never speak to a woman in public, not even their own wife. Religious leaders would take the long way round to avoid contamination by someone who was considered unclean. But here we see Jesus congratulating the supposedly unclean woman who touched him for showing such faith, and he called her daughter, family. Jesus refused to judge the prostitutes and the tax collectors, the sinners and the scandalous. Instead, he loved them and served them, healed them, and we're called to do the same. Religious beliefs or practices that exclude or shame or devalue people in any way are contrary to the way of Jesus. And there might be some of us here this morning who feel unclean or ashamed or unimportant. And if so, I hope and pray we'll be encouraged to reach out to Jesus. Perhaps, like the woman, quietly and unobtrusively, not wanting anyone to know, with a mixture of both fear and faith. Jesus can be trusted. He's good and loving and gentle and won't reject us. And we belong. And then thirdly and finally, I'd like to challenge all of us to think, what flows from our touch? I think it's fascinating that in this story, it seems Jesus didn't choose to heal the woman. But Jesus was so full of life and healing and wholeness that those things inevitably flowed out of him to those who had the faith to reach out and take them. When people meet us on the path, when they bump up against us in life, what flows out of us? Compassion and wholeness, or something else? What would a 16-foot painting of an encounter with us look like? As usual, we've got some discussion questions to help us think about these things more during the week, and you can download those from our website. But before we take communion, let's pray. Jesus, we thank you for your kindness, your gentleness, your acceptance of each and every one of us, your love for each one of us. And we reach out to you now. We long to touch you, to be healed and made whole. Help us too to be like you, to bring healing and wholeness to situations that might seem dark and hopeless, to love and serve without judgment. Dwell in us, Jesus. Amen.